Hello, welcome to today's audio program presented by Lancaster House. My name is Julie Nichols and I'm the moderator for today's program. I'm an arbitrator and mediator practicing in BC and I'm speaking to you this morning from a drizzly gray Vancouver. I hear it's sunny on the eastern seaboard, so I'll just be jealous over on the side. Our topic today is stress, overload, and burnout, prevention, accommodation, litigation. And both our speakers and our audience are joining us from across the Canada. To get started, I will begin by introducing our speakers, providing a brief overview of what we'll be covering today and going over how you can ask questions. First, it's my pleasure to welcome three accomplished speakers to our panel who will be providing their views on what stress is and how it may impact or affect your workplaces. So in alphabetical order, please welcome Heather Alden, who joins us today from Toronto, Ontario, and is a member of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation's legal department. The Federation specializes in education labor law on behalf of 60,000 English and French education workers employed by school boards, universities, and other educational institutions in Ontario. And Heather advises the Federation on a variety of labor, employment, human rights, and workers' safety issues. She also presents educational seminars for the members across Ontario. She graduated from the University of Toronto with a BA in honors, with honors in 1991 and from Osgoode Hall Law School in 1994. After her call to the bar in 1996, she worked in the United Steelworkers National Legal Department, and from 97 to 2008, she was the first general counsel at ATU Local 113, which is the union representing Toronto Transit Commission employees. So thanks for joining us today, Heather.
Glad to be here, Julie.
From Halifax, we have Kevin Kindred. He is legal counsel for Bell Alliant Regional Communications and specializes in labor, employment, and privacy law. Before joining Bell Alliant in 2006, he practiced in the Labor and Employment Group at what is now Cox & Palmer. Kevin has a Bachelor of Arts and a law degree from the University of New Brunswick, and he now teaches employment law at the Schulich School of Law at Dalhousie. While he practiced in both the union and the management side of labor law, he currently represents one of Atlantic Canada's largest employers and brings the employer side perspective to our program today. So thanks and welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Julie. I'm happy to confirm that we do have sun here in Halifax.
Thank you for rubbing that in. And last but not least, we have Dr. Michael Leiter, who is here from Acadia University in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, where he is professor of psychology, director of the Center for Organizational Research and Development, and holds the Canada Research Chair in Occupational Health and Well-Being. Michael is a registered psychologist in Nova Scotia and an internationally renowned professor for his work on job burnout and work engagement. His current initiative in research and consulting is CREW, which stands for Civility, Respect, and Engagement at Work, and improves collegiality within work groups. Michael received his BA from Duke University, his MA from Vanderbilt University, and his PhD from the University of Oregon. So thanks for being here, Michael.
It's great to be here.
Now, turning to our program, we have a lot of information to cover in the next half hour and a half. And in terms of a brief introduction, I was thinking about how many times one hears individuals refer to the fact that they're stressed out or that their day is stressful or that their lives are crazy and busy and hard to manage. And it seems to happen all the time and doesn't appear to be particularly unusual. Stress seems to be a recognized part of everyday life. We talk about it, we think about it, we feel it. We're sometimes motivated by it and sometimes bothered by it or negatively affected by it in varying degrees. In the article in your materials at page 19, a Statistics Canada General Social Survey indicated that in 2010, one in four workers describes their day-to-day lives as highly stressful. But what exactly is stress? And where is the line between the stimulation we experience in our day-to-day and the situations that can become potentially debilitating? We know that stress impacts the workplace. It affects all kinds of things: communication between employees, productivity, workplace satisfaction, attendance. Referring to that same article on page 23, it says that 62% of highly stressed people identified work as the source of their stress, and that the survey also indicated mental health problems alone cost employers $20 billion annually and account for three quarters of short-term disability claims in Canada. So we've all likely experienced workplace stress to some degree, as well as some personal stress that's probably difficult to leave at the office door. But when does that stress become something that should be addressed by the employer and or the union? If stress is dealt with, how should it be considered, reduced, or accommodated? And what kinds of information should be shared about an employee's circumstances in order to assist them in dealing with stress? So as you can see, this is a huge topic. We intend to canvas as much information as possible and look at a few scenarios so that our speakers can sink their teeth into some specific circumstances. To keep things organized, we've broken down our discussion into four segments. First, we'll look at recognizing and preventing stress. Second, we'll examine the issue of accommodating stress in the workplace. Third, we'll discuss the complexities around medical information. And finally, we'll cover how stress-related issues are being litigated. We'll discuss each of these areas for approximately 15 to 20 minutes, and we'll roughly follow the order of the materials that Lancaster House has provided to you. So you may have questions as we proceed. There will be two question and answer periods. One will be halfway through the program and another will be at the end. So please keep track of your questions as we go. Just before we begin the question period, I will explain to you how to enter the question queue so you can raise your question with any or all of our speakers. So let's begin and first take a look at when work-related stress becomes problematic. As we know, some stress in life can be a good thing, but it can also become harmful. I'll ask our panel to take a look at the difference between stress and other conditions and discuss some of its common causes. And we'll also discuss why it's important to reduce workplace stress and how that can be done. If you'd like to follow along in the materials, this area is covered from pages 9 to 50. So I'll start with you, Michael. Can you please describe when stress becomes harmful and can lead to burnout, and then perhaps the difference between stress and anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder and diagnosis of that nature?
Okay, Julie. Stress is, we're really designed to experience a fair bit of stress, and that, and as you mentioned, that it can be beneficial to some extent. The main limiting factor is that we can only really endure the stress response for a limited amount of time, that it exhausts a whole lot of energy. It's a very energy-intensive kind of experience for people, so that once they get aware of being in a uncertain or threatening or overly intense kind of situation, it gears up part of the autonomic nervous system, the whole physical response, which is more of a fight or flight kind of wired-in response that people have. And that brings with it a fair bit of tension and a real focusing of one's activities on dealing with this stress in one way or the other, either getting away from it or trying to make it go away. A lot of difficulty comes in the contemporary work world in that there are a lot of demands on people that this kind of response doesn't really help alleviate in any way. And in fact, with reactions to other people in the workplace can actually aggravate the extent to which people are feeling under stress. But the critical piece for stress is this balance of demands to resources. What are the demands that are coming at you, and are you confident that you have the resources, the knowledge, the skills, the network of people, whatever it takes in order to address that? So when that demand seems to outweigh the resource base that you have to work with, that people become particularly distressed under that kind of experience. Now, there are two parts to the stress reaction. The initial part is an alarm reaction where you get cranked up to do something, you know, run away from it or solve it or attack it or whatever it is. And then the second phase goes into an exhaustion phase. And that's when that energy that's been demanded from the initial response gets depleted. That exhaustion phase is what leads into burnout. And burnout is this experience of chronic exhaustion and sort of cynical withdrawal from the situation and just overall discouragement. So that response develops when people have been under a lot of stress within their work situation or home situation or wherever, and they have, in the course of that, really, they keep wearing themselves out. They carry around a lot of tension such that they, you know, have a hard time sort of recovering during that time. So they, and that's a critical piece of it, is that they lose really functional recovery cycles, either at work or at home or the combination. And so burnout becomes this chronic experience of just the exhaustion phase of experiencing stress. So with that, one of our key questionnaire items we use to assess a burnout is like, I feel tired in the morning when I wake up and face another day on the job. And with the idea that if you're feeling tired at the end of the day, well, that just shows that you did some work and so you've actually done something. But if you're feeling tired before you even start the day, it brings into question your capacity to recover from the demands that you are addressing within the workplace. And that can be both workplace health programs can facilitate with that, or just general lifestyle in terms of exercise, sleep, good nutrition, fun, all those kinds of things that help people bring back their energy so that they can be back into the game the next day or the next week with a full complement of energy.
Thank you. And would you say there's a difference between a stress reaction and anxiety, for example?
Well, a stress reaction is a reaction to what's happening now. Anxiety tends to be more future-oriented. So speaking anxiety is often sort of oriented towards how I'm going to be speaking in a moment more than at that particular moment. So anxiety, that's just... they're both a fear kind of response that overlaps to a great degree, but what we usually think about anxiety is more future-oriented.
Okay. And what's your view of the common causes of stress and the signs that it's becoming problematic? And you've also mentioned some of the things you can do to reduce stress. Are there any other things that we should be thinking about to reduce the stress we're feeling?
Well, a lot of what I look at in terms of the causes of stress, I look at sort of the management environment people are working in, because those are the kinds of things that when I'm advising managers that they can get some handles on and do things about. And there are sort of six areas. I'll see how many I can get through here quickly. But there's one is just the workload. And it's not so much the amount of work. But, I mean, that's an element of it. You can completely overload people so that they are just exhausted, period. But what we look at a lot here are what we call illegitimate demands, which are work that just to the individual seems unreasonable or unnecessary. It's just you're just loading work onto me, or just poorly organized work. That people, there's some kind of work that people really resent being sent their way, and that aggravates burnout more than just work per se. Another big issue is a feeling of control of can you actually shape and design your own workday the way that you'd like to. And the more constrained people feel, the more that they that feeds into the burnout equation. Reward and recognition tends to push people towards work engagement and away from burnout. A sense of community with the folks that you work with is the fourth big area that we look at. And that's a vital one, and that's led into our work on workplace civility as a means to actually alleviate people's experience of burnout. Justice, as your audience would certainly know about justice, but a sense of that subjective feeling that decisions are being made fairly, they're smart decisions, there is a clear process through which important decisions are made. That pushes people towards work engagement. Towards work engagement, and when people experience unfairness or injustice, they really get more. They feel like they're excluded from the work environment and go away from it. And then our sixth piece is just value congruence. Are you doing work that you truly believe in? That doing work for this. The more I work for this company, the better, the more I'm furthering my values as well as the values of that organization. And when those values are aligned, again, people become more engaged. When you feel it's at a conflict, I don't really believe that the work I'm doing here is useful or might even be harmful, then people tend towards the burnout end of the equation. So those are really key drivers. So from a management point of view, designing a work environment where you think about the balance of demands and resources, and also individuals' understanding of why it is important that they're doing this work rather than something else they might think of doing, and involving them in decisions in this whole system of recognizing people's contributions. That whole mix of things makes a world of difference, and it can push people towards either end of that continuum.
Thanks, Michael. I'd like to turn to Kevin now and ask you, Kevin, to discuss an employer's interests and obligations for addressing stress in the workplace and whether you think stress can justify a refusal to work.
Sure. Thanks, Julie. I should say, I know that a number of Bell Alliance own human resources folks are on the line, as well as some of our union people. So I should say right off that all of my comments are hypothetical. No one in the history of Bell Alliance has ever experienced workplace stress or burnout or, you know, anything other than the sheer bliss and rapture at the prospect of coming to work every day. However, the data tells us a different story about employers in general. So, you know, there are some great resources in the materials, and Julie's referred at several points to the StatsCan article that's at page 19. And that number jumps out at me the way that it did at her, that mental health issues cost Canadian employers an estimated $20 billion annually. And that's in the form of absenteeism, disability claims, and general overall reduced productivity among employees. And that makes sense when you think that, you know, in terms of players in the healthcare system, employers bear the brunt of the way that, that mental health issues are dealt with and treated, whether it's under their benefits plans or just as a result of absenteeism. So as HR folks and as union reps, what you'll probably encounter in terms of stress in the workplace are the strategies that employees use in response to stress. And I would put that in four categories, and you'll see that reflected in all the cases in the materials. But you'll see how stress impacts employees' performance, which will come up in whatever performance management system you have, how stress becomes a disciplinary issue, because as we all know, stress can sometimes impact people's better judgment and then has to be considered as part of considering any misconduct. It obviously will impact absenteeism and sick leave claims, and stress will engage with whatever your harassment management process is or your harassment prevention process is, as employees sort of try to reclaim some of the power over the workplace circumstances that are causing them stress. So So stress is obviously an important issue for employers to take seriously. In terms of the employee's refusal to work, that's a really specific occupational health and safety concept. And the cases mostly reject the idea that an employee can invoke their occupational health and safety right to refuse to work in response to stress. And in the materials, you'll see cases like that at pages 47 and 49. That specific right is intended to be an exceptional right in response to, and it depends on the wording of your statute, but unusual hazards or dangers. It's not intended that employees should be able to invoke that right as a means of seeking resolution to workplace conflict or as a way of obtaining leave from work that otherwise should be thought of as a sick leave claim. So stress may indicate all kinds of problems worth addressing in the workplace, but usually stress doesn't indicate a danger or a hazard within the specific meaning of occupational health and safety legislation.
Okay. Heather? I'm sure you might have some different views on an employer's obligation to reduce stress, or maybe similar, and whether workplace stress constitutes a danger that would justify a refusal to work.
Well, this doesn't happen very often, but I'm going to have to largely agree with what Kevin said on the issue of stress and occupational health and safety. But let me just start by saying, from a union perspective, there's no question that employers have a legal obligation to reduce workplace stress. After all, they have the responsibility for providing a health and safe workplace, and it's the employer, not the union and not its employees, that control the workload, the physical working conditions, or are required to manage interpersonal conflicts. That being said, the federal government and the provinces have not passed any specific legislation or regulations with respect to stress. So I'd say this legislative vacuum has led to some disappointing results for workers. As Kevin noted, the occupational health and safety decisions that have come out have confirmed that an occupational health and safety refusal cannot be done on the basis of stress, workplace stress. And I actually tried to note up the cases that were cited in the Lancaster House materials, and the Ontario law still appears to be, if you are facing workplace stress, the Ministry of Labour is not going to help you in a work refusal. Saying that, I wouldn't want to say that these decisions should not deter workers from refusing work in every case where they're experiencing workplace stress, particularly if that stress is in reaction to violence or a threat of violence or stress resulting from a physical risk in the workplace. But saying that, there are certainly more receptive and preferable forums for unions to address workplace stress, and I think we'll probably be getting to those in a bit.
Okay, well, let's turn to the issue of accommodation. And this is covered in pages 51 to 117 in your materials. What happens when an employee indicates they are too stressed to continue their normal duties or that stress has impacted their behavior in some way? Michael, I'll ask you to comment on two things. First, in your view, is stress a disability in and of itself, or does it aggravate or cause other recognized disabilities? And second, perhaps you can comment on whether stress can be a factor in employee misconduct.
Well, stress and burnout can certainly be debilitating, and they don't necessarily have to involve other established psychiatric disorders, though they do can be a sort of an entry-level kind of experience that can take people towards depression or towards anxiety disorders that are more established kind of psychiatric experiences that way. So it's, but it, they can be debilitating in that it's really like classical conditioning. People, the work context becomes the environment that prompts a strong reaction from somebody so that they can walk into the building and they feel either this weight that's coming down upon them in a more depressive kind of experience, or feel increasingly anxious as they are there. So that association can be closely tied to that environment. So, but for the most part with stress and burnout, you'll find that there are a lot of indicators of those that people are continuing in the work setting, but that they've lost part of the edge of both the fulfillment or the enjoyment or the effectiveness that they had when they are there. I'm working on an analysis with some colleagues in Finland who had a large body of data to work with, and it was looking at how people scored on the burnout inventory that we use and how that evolved over a few years in the late 90s. And then it relates those scores to their prescriptions for psychotropic drugs and particularly antidepressants in the following 10 years. And you can predict on the basis of their burnout scores who will be the prescriptions that they will be receiving over the following decade. So it really looks at a long-term kind of link between this experience and an established psychiatric disorder of depression, and that link is clearly there. The other dimension of your question of misconduct. We certainly do find in our data that there's a link between experiencing burnout and also experiencing a breakdown in the social network of a workplace, both in terms of either low scores on sort of team spirit on the positive end or a greater incidence of incivility or abusive interactions within work. And both individuals who are experiencing burnout, the relationships get strained, so they can be on either the receiving end or the instigating end of those kinds of relationships. But that part of what gets exhausted is the capacity of people to have constructive and fulfilling relationships with others at work or probably beyond. We look primarily at work, but it takes a lot of energy and attention to really have a constructive working relationship with somebody. And when you start losing the edge of bringing your energy and bringing your attention and involvement into your work and how it intersects with other people, that things can break down and a lot of bad behavior can result from that.
Hey, Heather, I'll ask you to comment on your perspective of whether job-related stress is a recognized disability that must be accommodated under the law, and if so, what does that duty to accommodate look like?
Thanks, Julie. It's clear that the law has determined that not all job-related stress is a disability. The StatsCan article that many people have been referring to suggests that 2.3 million Canadians feel stressed every day. So if we take that huge number, it is clear that some of that job-related stress that people are experiencing will fall under the definition of a disability. So the question is, where is the bright line? There is actually some arbitral tension in the case law on this issue. Some arbitrators and human rights tribunals have actually refused to recognize stress in and of itself as a disability. You've heard that Michael's mentioned, you know, it may be linked to other established psychological disorders. In this camp, the arbitrators and certain tribunals are saying that stress is not sufficient in and of itself. And I'd note the decision on page 67, the SkyTrain decision by arbitrator Steves, is sort of typical of this perspective, that stress is not a mental illness or a disability, and that you need a diagnosis with some specificity or substance. In other words, he's saying, the doctor's note saying that you experience stress is not sufficient. You should probably tie it to a DSM-4 diagnosis, you know, like anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder. Fortunately, I think that the ground has started to shift away from that perspective, and many arbitrators are actually recognizing that stress in and of itself can amount to a disability at a certain point. From the cases, I would say a union, in order to assist an employee to make out the case that a stress is a disability, a union should have evidence that stress is leading to serious and ongoing symptoms. And of course, the most common one would be an inability to work. Secondly, there should be some clear medical evidence that the condition and its impact on the employee is serious and has been diagnosed. You'll see some very good arbitration cases in your materials, and I suggest these two for the union folks listening. There's a case on page 127, arbitrator Whitaker, an SEIU case, where he clearly set out that stress, while it's not normally a disabling condition, there's no doubt that stress can be disabling. The one that I think is very good is by arbitrator Paula Knopf on page 63. And in that case, there was an employee who was working as a lab assistant where he was having to do, it appears, brain surgery on live rats. The things he was being asked to do, the experiments on these live rats, so grossed him out that he had to go off work because of stress. And arbitrator Knopf in that decision said, medically recognized stress that results in an inability to continue to work has been accepted as a form of disability, even if the stress is caused by one of the requirements of your job. In this case, it was his job to do these experiments. So let's assume that you've established that the stress is a disability. So what does the duty to accommodate look like for stress-related disabilities? You've heard from Michael this morning just a little while ago, that the lack of control is often a reason why people feel stressed at work. So if you think about it, there'll obviously be an inherent tension in addressing workplace stress, because this will involve wrestling control away from the employer, who's making all the decisions about the workplace. Fortunately, unions are perfectly suited to wrestle away control from the employer. That's what we pride ourselves on doing. And you'll see in the materials starting at page 51, there are a number of cases that outline the accommodations unions have assisted employees to receive because of stress. I'll just name a couple. The most common, obviously, accommodation for a stress disability is stress leave. So that's taken the form of short-term disability, long-term disability, and unapproved vacation time. A very interesting one is actually a requirement for the employer to police interpersonal relations. There's a case on page 86 where an employee was experiencing harassment from their coworkers because they had to use the bathroom frequently, but that was brought on because they had colitis. The employer wasn't doing anything about the harassment. That harassment caused the worker stress, which exacerbated their colitis. So the arbitrator actually found that the employer had been responsible for the stress the worker was feeling for not policing the interpersonal relationships. You'll also see that there was an order for a transfer to a different work environment and a different supervisor. And this is one that employees often want because the source of their stress is a supervisor that's very difficult personality. You'll see that that actually was ordered. The case is on page 94 by arbitrator Piché, but I should note that that accommodation was recommended in an IME, so that lent some weight to it. It wasn't just the employee and the union asking for it. They had a medical request that this would be needed. You will see that there's also cases about moving a work environment closer to a person's home because the long commute aggravated their high blood pressure. There was a request that a worker work from home rather than be in the workplace. That was actually rejected. That was a case on page 58. And I'll also note there was a case where the employee tried to have a director removed. In that case, both the union and the employer sort of acknowledged that would amount to undue hardship. But you'll see the sort of things that unions and employees will ask for to help reduce stress. I just give you a practical tip. To ensure you do get the accommodation you want, it's important for unions to help shepherd a good medical note. So make sure that the note an employee is providing is not vague, that it's directory, so it's telling the employer this is what needs to be done, and it doesn't simply regurgitate what the employee wants to happen, their opinion. You know, I want the preferential shift, not to work on Sunday, but really says these are the restrictions and you need to accommodate. I can't emphasize enough, these cases rise or fall largely on how good your medical evidence is to support your request for accommodation.
Thanks, Heather. Kevin, you might have a different view of how the law recognizes job-related stress, or maybe similar, but I'll ask you to provide your comments on that and how an employer should accommodate stress-related concerns. And perhaps you can also comment on the situation where an employee's stress is unrelated to the job, but perhaps arises out of their personal circumstances.
Sure. To start off, in terms of stress being a disability in and of itself, you know, sometimes lawyers are criticized for not being definitive enough in conferences like this. So I'd like to say something pretty definitive. I think the cases really do support that stress is not and never can be a disability in and of itself. And keep in mind that disability is not necessarily a medical term. It's a legal term. Stress may or may not be the cause of a medical condition, mental or physical, and it may or may not be a response to a medical condition, mental or physical, and those medical conditions may or may not be of such a nature that requires accommodation as a disability. But stress in and of itself, just invoking the word stress or the fact of stress, is not a disability, just like pain is not a disability and anxiety is not a disability. All of those things are features of the way that we interact with the world, which may or may not have any medical connection to them. So I emphasize that just because the idea that stress is a disability oversimplifies a lot of the important questions that have to be asked in the process of trying to manage a disability. So, you know, I certainly agree with Michael's comments that that stress can be debilitating. And, you know, I hope it's not not just a semantic point, but I take a lot of what Heather is saying about the cases in which stress has contributed to what gets characterized as a disability. Certainly she cited the decision by Paula Knopf, which, you know, I think is a low watermark on cases like this. But even in that case, it's important to know that it wasn't just stress in and of itself that we were talking about. There was stress that was together with anxiety, nausea, insomnia, and other, quote, psychological difficulties. I'm not sure I agree with exactly the way that the arbitrator treated the medical evidence in that case, but I don't think she was really dealing with stress in and of itself. If you refer to the case of SkyTrain, which is at page 67 of the materials, and it's the whole case is there, and it's really worth reading in detail, you know, that's a case where the arbitrator reviews medical evidence, and there was a lot of medical evidence in that case, and the medical evidence even refers to stress and depression and acknowledges that the employee was on antidepressants, and the employer was aware of that. And still, the finding in that case was that there was no disability, because just the fact that someone is stressed, or even the fact that someone is depressed or has periodically experienced depression and is taking a treatment for it, doesn't in and of itself say very much about whether that medical condition really interferes with a person's ability to work. And it's only at the point that there is a medical condition that interferes with the person's ability to work that we can rightly call it a disability. So I hope that's not a semantic point. I hope that that's a point of clarification that really helps us think about the cases that involve stress. In terms of personal stress, or stress that results from someone's personal life as opposed to their work life, you know, back to that really helpful StatsCan article at page 19, one thing you'll learn in reading that article is out of the employees who characterize themselves as highly stressed, 4 out of 10 attribute that to something other than work. So the suggestions as to how an employer can arrange the workforce in such a way as to reduce stress are very good and help with employee engagement. But that's not ever going to be a complete answer to stress in the workplace, because a lot of the stressors causing those conditions are things that employees are experiencing outside of work. So there are a number of cases in the materials where the employee's stress was rooted in causes outside work. For example, there is a nursing home case from New Brunswick at page 58 where the employee was seeking accommodation because she needed to spend time with her children in order to protect them from their violent father. So it's a very sympathetic situation. You know, in that case, there was some real questions as to whether the stress experience amounted to a disability. But in any event, the fact that the stress might be sourced within work, or it might be a response to conditions outside work, isn't different in and of itself in defining the disability. You know, that question is about what the employee is experiencing and whether it's connected to a medical condition that impairs their ability to work. And that's illustrated in the case at page 58. There are some differences that employers need to be aware of in managing stress cases, whether they're workplace-related or whether the stressor is coming from outside of work. Most importantly, your accommodation options are going to be different. So where it's workplace stress, the accommodations sought are going to be changes to the workplace to reduce the workplace stress. In other cases where the stress is coming from outside of the workplace, you're going to seek accommodations like time off and leaves. Maybe flexible work schedules like what was sought in the nursing home case at page 58. You also have different ways of dealing with the cases where there is it's personal life situations that are causing the stress. So some of the cases that you see reflected in the material, you know, are characterized or treated as sick leave cases. There's a Sioux Area Hospital case at page 127 and a BC Teachers Federation case at page 118, both of which really involved people seeking time off to care for ill family members. And those cases, I think, might just as easily be thought of as cases for compassionate care leave under whatever labor code provides to you, or cases for accommodation on the basis of family status or other discretionary leaves that you might have to apply. So your tool of options for dealing with employees who are experiencing stress outside of the workplace looks slightly different than the kinds of accommodations that might be sought where the stress is a response to workplace conditions. But fundamentally, it comes down to the same question. Is the stress related to a medical condition that causes an impairment such that it should be considered a disability?
Thanks, Kevin. Heather, what happens when an employee's misconduct is somehow related to stress? Do you consider that a mitigating factor?
Absolutely. So we know that an arbitrator, when they're assessing the reasonableness of a penalty, will look at any extenuating or justifying factors. So there's a clear arbitral consensus, I would say, that where a disability affects an employee's state of mind at the time of the offense, or where the misconduct was triggered or affected by an emotional problem or medical condition, arbitrators will take that into account and modify the discipline imposed. There are summaries of arbitration cases in your book that actually confirm stress-related disabilities will, in some cases, actually even completely excuse culpable behavior. There is a case at page 108, and in that case, the employee of a hospital abandoned a psychiatric patient on the side of the road. He actually told them to leave the van because the patient was being abusive. And then the employee returned to work, and he didn't report what he'd done. The employee was subsequently terminated, and lo and behold, he was reinstated with back pay, so no discipline at all. And that's because it was concluded that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. He'd previously been in a war situation, and the event had triggered reactions arising from the PTSD and made his actions not culpable. So in that case, it completely exonerated the griever. That being said, in most cases, a stress-related disability will likely explain but not completely excuse culpable behavior. And there are a number of cases in the materials where you'll see the arbitrator substituted lesser discipline. The one that I think is interesting on page 112, it's a CAW case where they actually were successful in having an employee who was terminated reinstated after he had threatened to take a hammer and do in his supervisor. It turned out that these provocative statements were the result of what they described as maladaptive stress-related response that was connected to an episodic major depressive disorder. He was reinstated with no loss of pay at all. I'm just going to turn back to a second to comments that Kevin was making. I think we do have to agree to disagree that stress, Kevin's saying he doesn't believe that stress by itself can constitute a disability, and I would differ with that. But I would say, because you know, as union people, that employers are going to take the position that stress is not good enough, that you need some other diagnosis. If at all possible, it would be preferable to have additional diagnosis to the stress. But if stress is the only one that an employee can be diagnosed with, I still say that's sufficient. But you will be faced with employers doubting that stress is something they need to accommodate.
Okay, Kevin, I'm going to give you the last word on this section and ask you about your thoughts on how an employer should respond when an employee says their misconduct was caused by stress.
Sure, and it doesn't surprise me that Heather and I are agreeing to disagree on that point, and it does reflect the fact that the cases aren't entirely clear or all aligned on the point, so I'll certainly give her that. I agree with everything that Heather said in terms of the impact that stress can have on the way that you make decisions around disciplinary or discharge decisions around misconduct. I think as an employer, it's important to keep in mind that there are two kinds of cases where stress becomes relevant to misconduct. One is just sort of the classic scenario where stress is a mitigating factor that explains the employee's behavior. There's a case like that at page 103 of the material, Smith and Romero. And really, that was an employee who sought time off to deal with a stressful personal situation and wasn't exactly in line with the procedures in terms of seeking the vacation time there, and because of some miscommunications was considered to be absent without leave, but really exercised a bit of poor judgment in the way that he took that vacation, but didn't really amount to an extreme amount of misconduct. So there, like in any discipline case, you would look at what mitigating factors might be going on that explained the employee's behavior, and it was pretty easy to conclude in that case that the personal stressors in his life led him to conduct himself in a way that he may not have in other situations, and a discharge was considered inappropriate in that case. So that's just sort of regular stress as a mitigating factor. The second is the kind of case that you see and Heather described at page 108 of the material involving the BC Nurses Union, where the employee isn't just claiming a mitigating factor, but actually claiming a disability that impacted their conduct. And in cases like that, you treat it like any other medical case, and you know that there will be some extreme cases, as such as this nurses' union one, where the medical condition completely explains away the employee's conduct and it's not really culpable. The more typical case is sort of a hybrid approach where some aspects are considered culpable and some aspects are considered more related to the disability and accommodation is required. But in a case like that, my tip to employers is that you should treat it as any other medical-related claim, and you're entitled to some kind of demonstration with medical evidence that there really is a disability at play there. You know, subject to the disagreement that Heather and I have about what that threshold is to identify a disability. You don't require that medical evidence if the employee is just saying, you know, I was stressed out and it affected me and I made bad judgment. That's a mitigating factor and you use common sense in dealing with a case like that. But if the employee is claiming a stress-related disability that impacted their culpability for the conduct, then you're entitled to look a little deeper and require that disability be demonstrated with medical evidence.